Isaiah, it is the 27th of October, 1988. We were talking last week about arriving in England. I wanted to ask you how your mother took to exile.
It's a perfectly good question, but I'm not sure I have a clear answer. She, unlike my father, was an Anglomaniac, as I told you, Angloman. She was all right. She was rather like an old Italian woman in New York. Firm, filled in culture, rather like somebody sitting on her bags in Ellis Island with 14 children, except she didn't have any of me. She took to it quite well. That is, she learned English. She never felt Italy at home. Not really. My father, too much so even. My mother could not quite enough. She remained a Russian Jewess. So to speak, reconstructed.
How do you know that she didn't feel at home?
Well, because I sort of noticed it in some way. She didn't make friends with the English. She had very few, my father had business friends and so on, to come to the house. She was always rather self-conscious and stiff with them. The maids in the house were, as a rule, foreign. You know, German, Italian sometimes, gypsies, all kinds of people. But they weren't straight English. When they were straight English, there was always like tension.
Did her English become good?
It wasn't ever perfect. She was a powerful character, strong personality, great sense of humor. And responsiveness for almost everything. She was musical. She had a very strong sense of people's characters, if she liked them or disliked them, there's no question, no doubt about the new situation. She was self-conscious. I felt she, in the presence of English Gentiles, which occasionally happened, particularly in my company afterwards, St. Paul's, I used to bring boys back to tea, because it was day school, and lessons, so to speak, stopped at 5. 5 o'clock I would go on foot, accompanied by 2 or 3 friends of mine, bring home to tea that was permitted, late tea. She was perfectly nice to them, but I didn't feel she was relaxed or free, ever.
What was her name?
You mean her Christian name?
Her Christian name, her
father. Marie.
Marie.
That really was her name. How she came to be called that in the ghetto, God only knows. But she was called, in her passport, she was Maria. Maria Isakovna. Her father was called Isaac. Therefore Isak. Maria Isakovna.
And her family name, to remind me,
her family name was very mysterious, very odd. Volshonok. Volshonok was a corruption of Volchonok, which means little wolf. Volk. Mm-hmm. The original name was, I'm sure, Wolfson. Mm-hmm. But since these people always tended to Russify names, plus I had an uncle called Samunov, who married my mother's sister. But the original name was Zamenhof, which is the name of the inventor of Esperanto, for example, Dr. Zamenhof.
So Volchonok would be
Volchonok.
V-O-L-S?
V-O-L-S-H.
O-N, okay.
O-N-O-K. Not name born by anybody that I know of, except by her father and his brothers.
So her Christian name is Marie. What do you call her at home, if I may ask?
I don't know if I called anything. Mama, I think. Mm. Or Mama, as I learned to call her later.
Yes. Did you always...
Mama was a Russian.
Yes.
For that. And Mama was slight upper class English. And I didn't call her Maman.
Yes.
So I called her Mama towards the end of my life. Quite unconsciously.
Yeah.
But Mama is what I call them. Mm. Papa and Mama. Those are the ordinary Russian names.
You always spoke Russian to her in the home?
No. No, I didn't. I took English. No, I did not talk Russian. Now and then, when she lost her temper, which occasionally used to happen, she would then break into Russian. Whereas I would break into Russian too. Then she would say, talk English. Talk English. Because she thought I'd be much ruder to her in Russian than I would be in English. I was not to exploit Russia for the purpose of inflicting some kind of wound upon her. Talk English, that's more formal. Let's go over to English, more formal basis to discuss this, that's what that meant. But no, I talked English. I talked English from the third month of my being in England, continuously. I knew Russian.
Did you have English tutors
yes?
to learn English?
Yeah, well, the very beginning, yes, in Surbiton, there was a Russian woman who, I think an English woman, lived in Russia a long time or something, must have come in answer to the incident. She taught me English, yes. She taught me long vocabularies, lists of words, no grammar. That I picked up by about, I was about 6 months in 1920. I spoke it adequately.
Did you have a sense when you came to England that you'd come down in the world?
No. None.
Because there was there were maids, you're saying? There was a tutor?
There was a maid in the house. Mm-hmm. There was one maid, that was all. There was an English tutor who used to take me to the zoo in London. Mm-hmm. He was a undergraduate, I think.
But you didn't feel you'd come down in the world?
In no degree. Neither up nor down. Nor have I ever had that feeling in my life in general.
Because your father took up with his...
Did exactly what he did before. Mm. Originally supplied the government, and I became a private trader.
Yes.
But I mean, he went
but
to
But trading, continuing
timber.
To trade in timber.
Exactly the same thing. He went to the city in the morning, had an office, had a company, had one partner, and everything went on exactly as before. Came home in the evenings. Read the Evening Standard, and after that, had dinner, read the Evening Standard, went to bed. Who gave him a book, read a book. Never got one for himself or anything.
Whereas your mother would have read books.
My mother read books in German, very considerably, when she was in Russia. But she was bilingual. She read, or certainly she did, she read what people, fairly advanced persons, read then.
Such called as?
Knut Hamsun. Because it was a great Russian Gamsu.
Yes.
Yes, Gamsu, widely read in Russia. Mm. She read Kuprin because he was so friendly to the Jews.
Yes.
That's a very good reason. It's like Arthur Aline and Nantes in Paris, called Madame Alphen, the very rich, grand, sort of French Jewish family, practically 18th century. And she had a marvelous collection of pictures. And someone said, Madame Alphen, il n'y a pas de dégâts. Vous n'avez pas de dégâts? No, no. Parce qu'il est antisemite.
Voilà.
In the Dreyfus case.
Yes.
That's the only test of it, you right. No, my mother had a very acute sense of the Jews and so on. She read Hamsun, she read Baroness Zutna, whoever she was, with some kind of Austrian feminist, I would say. Yeah. There were stamps with her on, and coin in modern Austria, you get Baroness Zutna somewhere. No idea who she was. She read Edith Lawrence. With great admiration.
Really?
Yes.
In English?
Yes. She read Lawrence. She read, what else did she read? She read Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. All that she read. She was, in that sense, quite civilized, but she remained lower middle class.
What, when you say lower middle class,
in
what does
Jewish
that mean
sense,
in
somehow
particular?
At the roots were in the ghetto, in the Riga ghetto. It wasn't a real ghetto, as I did. It was just where the poor Jews lived. The roots were there, that's the world she understood, that's the world she liked, that's the world in terms of which she used to talk about it, and described characters and personalities in it with great vividness and great humor.
Yes.
She had a considerable gift for penetrating things of human nature, describing very characteristic stories of the way people behaved to each other.
Can you remember stories
and
that you heard as a
no,
child?
No,
from
no,
your
no.
Mother?
I don't know. Not a single one.
But when you say that she had a kind of lower middle class ghetto character, how did that translate in terms of behavior?
It turned
things
that,
she did.
That she wasn't comfortable in England. That's all I mean. Mm. She was a natural Zionist. She was a chairwoman of little Zionist societies in Hampstead and dominated them totally. Mm. Lord Goodman's mother was one of her clients. She was the most hideous woman I've ever seen in all my life. She was a monster. Appearance. And that's why when Goodman, who was after all not a beauty, and when he was suggested to her, after her solicitor died, was a perfectly nice man called Snowman, who was the uncle of the man who looks after the South Bank at the moment, music and words. When he died, comparatively young, the question was who should employ a solicitor. And the accountant who was working for it suggested, couldn't. He said, I can't. It looks terrible. I can't get along with him. I can't.
Because of memories of mother.
What?
Because of memories of mother.
No. Because of his appearance.
His appearance.
Yeah. No, the mother, she was quite nice to a poor woman. Yeah. Very hideous. Yes. And ugly, but kindly and amiable. And one shouldn't be nasty.
Yeah.
But Goodman struck her as, looked rather like, lead to her rather like that leader of the Mau Mau, do you remember?
Jomo Kenyatta.
What? Yes. Rather like Kenyatta. Kenyatta-like look. He looked at her sort of terrible ugly mouth. She sort of recoiled. Right. She couldn't.
Right. Let me.
When her solicitor became my solicitor, it was the corpus, with me, who was a solicitor to the Privy Council, to the cabinet practically, and to a number of millionaires. Although she got on quite well with him, she was never completely comfortable. He was too grand. So that's what I mean by saying that there was social self-consciousness, which was due to our origins.
Yes.
You see, the name Rothschild meant too much to her.
Yes.
When old Mrs. Rothschild used to come and see me in Hampstead, but that was 40 years ago, when I was ill, she would call. My mother was transported with pleasure.
Mm. Yes.
You see, I used to be very humiliated by that.
Yes.
I disliked that very much.
Yes.
For obvious reasons.
Yes. Yeah. How did she dress? Do you remember how she...
Perfect old, nothing very much. She dressed like any woman of our class would dress. Perfect ordinary clothes.
You don't remember her as a stylist?
She was fat, no. She was fat. They both fat, my parents. That's what I am as I am. And
I beg your pardon.
Yes, I'm fat all right. Certainly. Every time I eat proper lunch, proper dinner, I will eat fruit supper. And I have a complex about weighing myself every morning. No, she was plump. She dressed pretty neatly, perfectly nicely, but not very grand. And when balls occurred, or evenings which I go out, it was a little overdone.
Yes.
My father always disliked her clothes. She thought she was too, I don't know, her stockings weren't tight enough, sometimes wrinkled.
Yes.
He couldn't bear that.
Yes.
The dress sometimes didn't sit on her,
yes,
the degree of elegance, which one really rather expected. He didn't say anything very much, but he winced.
Yes.
The difference between them, class-wise, their first cousin, was dead, funnily enough.
Yes.
He assimilated to some very different form of life from hers. Although he was in love, he loved her, and she didn't love him. As I
said, she didn't love him?
No.
How did you know that?
This is obvious. She picked quarrels with him of a bitter and unnecessary kind. He was a very nice, peaceful, sensitive, charming, sort of honorable, not very interesting man. There's no jam in his donut at all. Something was lacking in the center. He never lived his life. When he died, it was very pathetic. He was to me like a schoolboy. I mean, he never really experienced very much. And he died innocently, as he had lived, without having been through any kind of emotional turmoil, or having ever done anything interesting, or been in anything interesting. It had no real life at all. Rather like that story by Henry James, it's called The Beast in the Jungle, remember? When the man says, if you haven't had your life, what have you had?
And he didn't.
No.
But and she
resented being married to him. Because she thought he was a dull man and depended too much on her and was uninteresting. And she was very sexy, my mother, basically. Nothing ever happened. Or remotely happened. But she really wanted to be loved, she wanted to be lifted, she wanted some kind of emotional relationship with somebody, which she never had. She resented the fact that she was relegated in this way. That's why all the love was directed at me, you see. And I really could have been ruined by it, but if I wasn't, it was a little mysterious. I wasn't mother fixated. Then I wasn't. I could have been, and should have been, but I wasn't.
Why?
Don't know, because I mean, I never knew what it meant. I mean, it just didn't happen. Because I have an easy nature. Because by nature, I'm very unfixated. Indian.
And also there was a very strong counter pull in your life, which is to both.
Well, school and college, and I had another life.
Yes.
I mean, when I came home, it was home. I had a meal, I had dinner, and after dinner I went upstairs and worked. Then we went on holidays together. It was very economical, which was to irritate both my father and me. He was tended to be a spendthrift, slightly. He liked luxury, liked comfort. When we used to go, even after the war, when we went to Switzerland, he stayed in the Hotel de Berg, which was a respectful hotel in Geneva. She would stay in the boarding house.
With you?
With me. I was there already, but I didn't mind where I stayed. She was always trying to find third-class hotels. My father found unbearable. So there were conflicts about that.
Yes.
In the end, she would win. My father was in permanent discomfort as a result. Couldn't understand why. She said, well, the day may come when all the money I've accumulated as a result of not spending all her house money might come useful against a rainy day. It very nearly happened, it never did. In fact, my father did think he was ruined once, but he wasn't.
When was that?
At the war, the beginning of the war, the last war. And suddenly Riga was cut off. You see, there was no timber, and he had debts to settle, which he couldn't because he had no goods to sell. And the goods dropped in summer, those sort of things for some reason dropped in value. Well, part of the financial crisis of 31, really. But that was that he got out of comparatively easily. But in 39, well, I'm now running ahead. I remember.
Sorry, we can pick that up.
Come
later.
To it later. Yes.
I wanted to come back to your mother because I.
She had a powerful, strong character and influence on me, in the sense that she, somehow, I think what I derived from her, is a very strong sense of whether people are substantial or not. Whether they have substance, have insides, and are dependable, and have some kind of personality, of a real kind, or whether or not they are frivolous and unreliable and trivial. And
that was her basic distinction between people.
I think she never said it. Yes. You see what I mean? She
would have been cruel enough to put her own husband in the second category.
Well, I didn't suppose she allowed herself to think that quite. But I suppose she would have been asked. She was a thought, yes, he was. Yes, it was trivial, yes. Not worth it. Nice, amiable. What she liked was strong men, strong women. And historically, too.
Who were her heroines and heroes?
Well, no, certainly no Gentile figures. She was steeped in Judaism. I didn't notice that, I remember.
Yes.
More so as she grew older. I don't think she had heroes in that sense. I don't think she did. Did she ever call him a very great man? No.
Did you have a...
She wasn't at least historically minded.
Yes.
I mean, she knew who Catherine the Great was, but didn't understand what Peter the Great was. Didn't extend far beyond it.
Did you, in the end, have a confessional relationship with her?
No, I did not. I did not.
You didn't come and tell her your troubles?
No.
Even from the beginning, at any time?
I never told anybody my troubles. I don't think I ever did. I think I didn't have any many troubles because I didn't tell them. And because I didn't tell them, they, in a sense, evaporated. Troubles are much more painful if it's false to say that relief is obtained by confession. And on the contrary, one becomes much more aware of what they are in the telling of them. By being described, you alter them somewhat, and they become engraved to a high degree.
But isn't that a defense of the uses of repression, as I
have? Well, yes. I'm all in favor of that. I was very repressed. I have no doubt I had complexes. Well, sex, for example, you see, meant nothing to me at all for far longer than in the case of ordinary boys. I never masturbated in my life. Never felt tempted to. Never did. I think I was almost unique in that respect. I had no idea what it was, but what it was. Mm. Yes. So this is something very abnormal from my upbringing. Certainly.
But you.
But I think we better go back chronologically.
Yes, I wanted to just to get the sense. We are now in the early 20s. You moved from.
I didn't think I would confess anything to anybody. I think he was unhappy. If I was unhappy, I followed it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I didn't think I talked to my friends either. I was a talkative boy, and quite open. But if I was frustrated at school, or offended, or insulted by a master, or failed in something, I think I was just unhappy. But I didn't think I talked about it. I didn't think I complained very much. I was irritated by being made to do this rather than that.
Yeah.
And my mother used to go into my bedroom in the morning. I used to have breakfast in bed, as I was spoiled, in that sense. And would say, well, what is the plan for today? It used to madden me. I have no plan. I don't intend to have a plan. It's the age of 13, I said that. Plan. That's what she was like. She was tidy, she was strong-willed, and she wanted life to be orderly.
Was your father essentially absent from your child?
Strong sense of money, my mother had. Mm-hmm. Strong sense of who was rich and who was poor. Which is a Jewish thing in general. The point about the Jews, you know, that the only security they ever had was money.
Yes.
More than other. And that's why they accumulated the whole secret of money lending or wealth or general money mindedness in a lot of Jews. Because of that, the truth was all they could cling to. Because from every corner, terrible insecurities.
Yes.
Threatened them. They could be expelled, they could be imprisoned. They could be killed, anything could happen. This is the only thing with which they could buy a certain degree of independence. Consequently, my mother was also brought up in that world, very conscious of the differentials of wealth. And one of the reasons, and no doubt, I should think she wore, I think, two rings on her fingers, which is what it's like, diamonds, diamond ring, golden ring. I can't look at jewelers' windows now. I have an absolute phobia.
Because of the elements of display.
Probably. And the other Jewish friends too. I mean, I used to go to these. There was an annual party given by an organization which was founded by Aline's grandfather, which was intended to make Jews artisans and productive workers. It was called Ort. And David Young has introduced his methods, was head of it in England, introduced his methods now in the Church of England.
Yeah.
They work extremely well. Anyway, there was an annual ball in London under the auspices of this organization, which was called something like, in Russian it was Organizatsiya Raboty Truda, something like that. In England, Organization of Rehabilitation through toil, I don't know, some nonsense, trade, or something of the sort, you see? Well, they had to translate it somehow. Well, all the sort of bourgeois Jews, Lord Beloff's parents, those rich and sort of affluent Jews living in Hempstead, used to turn up and listen to this. I was occasionally taken. Once a year, this was a kind of self-identifying act on the part of mainly Russian Jews, in line with whom otherwise my parents didn't keep up. And I used to see these bejeweled ladies, these huge fat fingers, you see, and these jewels shining upon them. And it was obviously an exhibition, I mean, tremendous demonstrations of wealth.
And it left a certain distaste.
Very violent distaste. There are two things I agree. I can't look at that, and I hate looking at shops with women's clothes in them. I have no wish to look at them. I think not the slightest interest. Men's clothes, yes. I think that was highly homosexual on my part. I like knick-knack shops with odds and ends that I like best.
Yes.
Knick-knacks. Yes. I mean, mixed objects, mixed goods of every sort.
Yes.
Pen knives,
yes.
Bird cages,
yes.
anything like. I mean, the sort of gadgets, million kind.
Yeah.
Which was very good.
Let's now resume the narrative thread a little.
What? Banks.
Yes. You start in Surbiton, you stay in Surbiton
for about just under a year.
Right.
We begin in February.
February 20.
Yes, and I think I took Cockney then because the other boys took it.
Yes.
I called money Chink.
Yes.
They called it, I think.
Yeah.
And I probably said a thing I say, I think I probably said I saw it. I suspect.
Yes.
This must be so because the maid who looked after us, whenever she anything said to her, said, I say, meaning I see.
Right.
No, I say, but I see, not I say. I say, but I see.
Right. When do you move to Hampstead?
Well, in 1929.
But you're in Surbiton and then?
And then in Kensington.
Kensington.
We move from Surbiton. My mother broke her ankle and was offered to move to London. We had to be set. And went to a nursing home for about a fortnight. And some grand doctor looked after her. And then I remember him, Lord Dawson of Penn. He was a king's doctor and a real old fashioned bedside manner charlatan. The Lord and Lord Eccles is his son in law. And he looked after my mother. And then during that period, that took a month, I think. During that month, I lived my life at school in Surbiton because I was never to look after at home. And then my father only came back in the evenings from the city to Surbiton. So I stayed at school from 8:30 in the morning till 9, or then 8:30. I lunched and I dined there. That's when I was taught English manners, which I don't think I had when I arrived. I think I probably speared bits of meat. Or head piece off a knife, or I've done anything. But I imitated the other boys.
Yes.
And presently, the headmaster and his new wife were very nice to me. I was a poor foreign boy.
What was the name of the school?
Arundel House School.
Arundel.
Still exists.
Yes.
In Surbiton.
Yes.
As far as I knew. Headmaster's name was Bastable. And it was a BCom from Birmingham.
And when did you go to Covent Court or St. Paul's?
I'll tell you. Then my mother's ankle cracked, and then it was difficult. She limped a certain amount. And the question was, could she really be brought back to Surbiton? There were no doctors, no surgeon took after her. So then she decided to move. We moved, I would say, in the winter, Christmas roughly, of 1920. 21. And we moved to Hotel. We lived in the Kensington Palace Hotel. It still exists on its own name. You know where it is.
Yes, exactly.
There we lived for about 4 months. And I absolutely adored it. Breakfast brought by a waiter, delicious scrambled eggs, which I didn't get in Surbiton. I like being in food and restaurant very much. The whole idea of lunch and restaurant pleased me very much. Because it's after the comparative squalor of all these confined Russian and even English houses, this grandeur of a restaurant, a waiter, and this wonderful food, which was quite unlike the Jewish food my mother prepared, which was perfectly, ordinary English food. I was delighted by all that. There we stayed for 3 or 4 months. This would have brought us to We came in March in February 31. We moved in Royal Palace Hotel in about December 21. Stayed there till about May, let's say.
22.
Or 32. At this point, I was given tutors in order to get some Paul Niles and Philip. My father knew the KKC, King's Council called Stuart Bevan. We must have done some business with him. We talked to him in a big way. They became friends. He was the governor of Westminster School. He said, you've got a boy, he's got to go to Westminster. It's a very good school, I recommend it. So I was put down for Westminster. I was then given a coach, whose name I've forgotten, in New Quebec Street, I think, or Old Quebec Street, off the Fontenoble Arch, where cramming went on. Upstairs, the classics downstairs, mathematics. Mr. Bell taught me mathematics. Mr. Crouch taught me the classics, that was the name. And just straight cramming with five other boys. Westminster School accepted me without examination. But for some reason, there was some test I had to pass. Not the easy kind. Or a scholarship examination, maybe. I did something. And Mr. Crouch said to me, your name is Isaiah. Maybe boys in Westminster will be unfamiliar with that. Then it'll be easier for you if you took on some ordinary English name. Why don't you call yourself James, Robert, something like that? That, for some reason, upset me. And I didn't like it at all. And I thought, oh dear, I understood already. Here's a boy with people wearing top hats, which they did just as much as they did. They wore even jackets. It was a smart school, it was more then than now. King's scholars and them worshipped as they do now in Westminster Abbey. They're all very Christian in a way. There were Jews there, but not very, very few. And suddenly I came home and I said, no, I didn't want to go to school where I had to change my name. I didn't think I'd feel very happy there. And my friend Leonard Shapiro, with whom I used to play in the English Garden in Petrograd, who came from a grander Riga family than mine, went to Spalls. And I said, well, I know Leonard, he seems quite happy there. He's 2 years older. You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely.
Leonard writes all his books.
Absolutely.
As you see, can't I get St. Paul's too? But it's all right, boys. And inquiries were made, and we found there were 70 Jewish boys there, or some large ghetto at St. Paul's. You see what I mean?
Yes.
I was telling all the sort of Jewish bourgeoisie, sometimes Leonard Wolfe, Victor Collins. That was the kind of school it was. That sort of thing, you see what I mean? So then all the sort of German Jews that came here, prosperous German Jews, sent their children. And so I put up some polls instead. My parents were surprised by this reaction. But I, curiously enough, it was one of the few self-consciously sort of decisive acts I ever took in my life. I said, I'm not going there. I didn't want to. Any other crisis that then I did my bar mitzvah in the new West End synagogue, which was very smart, kind of real West End affair.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't allowed to sing the portion of the Bible which boys in that condition do, because I was adjudged to have no musical sense whatever, and I wouldn't do it right. And I received a prayer book in the hands of a man called Sir Meyer Spielman, who was the chief warden. All this I remember. And everyone wore top hats there too. So I wore a top hat there, but not at Westminster.
Yes.
And I went to St. Paul's, which was within walking distance. That's why they settled in Kensington.
Yes.
In the end, to make it possible for me to go to school on foot,
yes,
should I wish to do so.
Yes.
The only other thing which happened to me of a critical nature, which was of some interest, which I didn't ever thought about until this moment, was it? One day I told a lie, great, big, bold, gratuitous lie, to the effect that on Friday morning or something, I'd gone to see Mr. Crouch, and he said this and he said that, and then I came home, and then they wanted me for something, and they hadn't telephoned there, saying, could they speak to me, and I wasn't there. When I came home, they said, why did you say, where were you, I was there, but you weren't, we telephoned, he said, I hadn't seen you all morning. It was an absolutely gratuitous lie. I didn't know what I was doing. I walked the streets. I went to my grandfather in a court in Kensington High Street.
Mm-hmm.
I was 30. You see, exactly what I was. And then my father became colossally upset. Colossally upset. And couldn't speak to me. And said he never would live to the day when his son did something so absolutely dreadful. I'm sure I was reduced to tears. I don't remember what I was, but I. So, and my mother also, but my father thing was, he couldn't speak to me, and it broke his heart. And he didn't know I was going to go on. He made fuss of an unbelieving. That did make some dent upon me. And although I can't say that I've never told a lie since then, the whole idea of lies being wrong and the value of the truth, I think in some way was ingrained into me. I didn't tell them easily. And I do tell a lie.
It gives you trouble.
Yes. You see? Certainly gives me trouble. Quite a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
You see? I tell myself I'm really afraid of being found out. But it isn't quite it.
Mm.
And I have great respect for truth tellers. Mm. Who will, never mind what even the hurt feelings, carry an incapable lie. Kant.
Mm. Yes.
Kant is a philosophy, that is.
Yes.
However, I then did a bar mitzvah called Noah. There was a little dinner given before. I had to make a little speech. That was in frightful agony and nuisance. And then I went in for a scholarship at St. Paul's and didn't get it. But I was put down the ordinary way because I felt it was a prosperous life, not to need it. And then I went to school at the end of 23. In fact, September 23 is when I went to St. Paul's. I was put in a morning. I don't think any very strange happened to me there. Some masters I liked, some didn't. But on the whole, I was unhappy in one of the forms, because the master was obviously a kind of sublimated, old-fashioned homosexual. Didn't much like me. Didn't think it might even have been a trifle anti-Semitic. Might have been. But that couldn't be. It never emerged. But under him I felt bullied. And I didn't know the sort of thing English boys knew. My education was too rapid. For example, when I was told to write notes on the following characters, Beatrice, Buck. I had no idea who Beatrice Buck was. So I wrote this down as Beatrice Buck. I didn't know who Buck was. Beatrice, I thought, was the lady Dante was in love with. Which is quite correct.
Yes.
Beatrice, he said, even said, Beatrice, you go, he calls her. Yes, Beatrice is right. That wasn't what was wanted.
Yeah.
And so, there's a Shakespearean background, which the other boys obviously had by the time they were 13.
Yes.
I did not know this. That's not what I was taught at my prep school. All I was taught at my prep school for 9 months was the New Testament, which I took to in a big way. I enjoyed that very much.
Yes.
My parents had no objection. I read the epistles, the greatest interest.
Yes.
Museum. And there's other things that's on Latin. A little bit of Latin, a little bit of English essay writing. Grammar, that sort of thing. But I had no idea about Buck. And I didn't know who Buck was. I didn't know who Beatrice was. Hardly Hamlet I had heard of.
Yeah.
Now that was an obstacle. So I used to come home and used to ask my parents who these characters were. And I had an aunt, my father's mother's sister, who was very saintly, and who was a mathematician by training, and who was then a rather elderly student at LSE. She taught me mathematics to the extent to which I was never able to do it. It was always a torment to me. She taught me that. She told me about Bach and Beatrice.
Right.
Then after that, I was perfectly happy at school. No trouble at all. I was quite popular with other boys. Masters quite liked me. I was never top of form. Never. No second. Sort of respectable, I mean, 8th, 9th. I was never 20th, and I was never near the top. I worked very hard, but I wasn't very gifted. I never really learned Latin and Greek properly. Because I used cribs that I cheated. That's why I never learned Latin as I should have done. You see? I didn't use cribs at first, but later, certainly. I used to go to Charing Cross Road and buy these Tupney and Threepney translations of the Aeneid. Nothing has stopped me.
No, we're fine. I wanted to know...
I played games.
How were you at games?
Not bad, not good. I played cricket, I played football. I played soccer at my preparatory school, prep school. And I played... I even bought a football. So addicted to it. I used to do sort of kick it about in a jolly manner. And I played cricket, not well. I played tennis, though. We lived in one of those houses in what is now called Upper Edison Gardens, which was a large green lawn-like thing between the houses on one street and another, you know, some of these commons. Mm-hmm. And that was tennis court. Yes. And I used to play tennis pretty badly. I played it. Yes. I used to get headaches, rather, for playing. My left arm didn't quite function. But I'll tell you about my cricketing career. I played quite steadily at St. Paul's. I was no good, but I didn't suffer. I didn't like it very much. I didn't lose it. But one day, already quite late in life, I was about 16, 15 perhaps, the ball came. Came towards me. I struck it with my bat. But I was very awkward always. I made 5 runs, 6 runs, never 20. And I was a low tee. The ball went perpendicular upwards. Someone tipped it upwards in a very awkward way. And the field came and cupped its hands in order to catch it. I caught it myself. It seemed to me to be coming down from my head. This has never happened in the game of cricket. It could be in the modern book of records.
Absolutely.
It was not well received. It was thought rather cynical, rather immoral, I can see.
Yeah.
Very, very enormously disliked.
Yeah.
It was somehow mockery of the game. After that, I wasn't allowed to play. For about 6 months, I could score, be an umpire.
But you couldn't take the game in vain?
No. For 6 months, I was semi-ostracized for that.
But you weren't regarded at St. Paul's as a kind of tremendously studious, owlish...
No, don't think so. No, I wasn't.
Did you wear glasses from childhood?
No, in England, from my prep school. That's when I suddenly became short-sighted and see. I was given a pair of glasses about a month after I arrived. Some of my parents noticed. Some in Russia, not. No. I wore glasses, yes. Because I was short-sighted in the only way. And I worked quite hard, and I quite enjoyed my school life. The thing was, it was a cramming establishment. We were at school from 9:30 till 1, and 3 till 5. And we lunched wherever we liked. We didn't have lunch at school, so we went at lunch at Lions Corner, the Lions Restaurants, or ABC, as it was called in those days. Or there's something dairy company,
yes,
with my other schoolboys. That was very nice.
Yes.
We walked towards Emerson Broadway and had the jolly lunches for 10 pence.
What uniform did you wear?
None. When I was at junior school, you wore, I think, an ordinary suit. No, it wasn't uniform until we became older. I think we wore maybe a flannel grey flannel suit. I never wore short trousers, but the senior school wore a black jacket and grey striped trousers. The junior school wore caps, the senior school wore bowler hats and walking sticks.
Yes.
To that extent, that degree of somebody, but socially, it was not a public school. Officially, of course, it was. Founded in 1511, St. Paul's Churchyard originally. The social range came from the children of astronomers royal or civil servants, to policemen sons, or bank clerk sons. Very old range. It was really grammar school in texture.
Yes.
The public school officially.
Yes. My father's memory of it is of great unhappiness.
Why?
I think he felt young, He felt initially his English wasn't very good, he felt bullied, he felt...
What did he do, history? History of classics?
Yes, history. He wasn't terribly... I think he wasn't very happy. His brothers became kind of prefects and boxers and had a good kind of outdoor English,
not
robust kind of public school.
I know he was a prefect. I was never a prefect.
Is St. Paul's a moment when you get a sort of dawning intellectual interest, some subject begins to emerge?
Yes, yes. The point about St. Paul's was, because it was a London school, and because there were these quite clever, sophisticated boys, some of them, we went with concerts, and we went to exhibitions and pictures. And by the time they came to Oxford, most little Paulines were exhausted. They were sort of spent.
Yes.
They were rather knowing. Yes. They'd been to too much. Unlike the public school boys who were preserved
yes.
in some kind of airspeak. You see, these were sort of ran about with probably Westminster, much the same, or Merchant Taylors, or City of London, all these London schools. And we read books, I mean, we read fashionable books. By the time I got to the, I suppose, upper seventh form, or eighth form, which was the name of the sixth form, I suppose, I must have been told to read the sort of clever boys, read Joyce, and they read Eliot, and they read Carl Sandburg,
yes.
suddenly, just thrown in,
yes.
thrown in. Or, I don't know what, Humbert Wolfe was a great poet of those days. But that sort of thing is very sophisticated.
Yes.
Pretentious sophisticated. That was the point. But my homework is very heavy. I wanted to work, at least I did, because I'm slow work. I had to work quite hard, for after dinner I used to go, and then there was a thing called repetition, to learning verse, my heart was in English or Latin. That was a nightmare to me.
Right.
That's all I'd forget.
Yes.
That's one thing which used to darken my mornings. At breakfast and so on, I used to try and memorize these things. And I knew that if not the